Chapter 5. Dulcie Domum.
The sheep ran huddling together against the hurdles, blowing out thin nostrils and stamping with delicate forefeet, their heads thrown back and a light steam rising from the crowded sheep pen into the frosty air, as Rat and Mole hastened by in high spirits, with much chatter and laughter. They were returning across country after a long day's outing with Otter, hunting and exploring on the wide uplands where certain streams tributary to their own river had their first small beginnings. And the shades of the short winter day were closing in on them, and they had still some distance to go. Plodding at random across the plough, they had heard the sheep and had made for them, and now, leading from the sheep pen, they found a beaten track that made walking a lighter business, and responded, moreover, to that small inquiring something which all animals carry inside of them, saying unmistakably,
"Yes, quite right. This leads home."
"It looks as if we're coming to a village,"
said Mole, somewhat dubiously, slackening her pace as the track that had in time become a path and then had developed into a lane now handed them over to the charge of a well-metalled road. The animals did not hold with villages, and their own highways, thickly frequented as they were, took an independent course, regardless of church, post office, or public house.
"Oh, never you mind," said Rat.
"At this season of the year, they're all safe indoors by this time, sitting around the fire, men, women and children, dogs and cats and all. We shall slip through all right, without any bother or unpleasantness. And we can look at them through their windows, if you like, and see what they're doing."
The rapid nightfall of mid-December had quite beset the little village as they approached it on soft feet over a first thin fall of powdery snow. Little was visible but squares of dusky orange-red on either side of the street, where the firelight, or lamplight of each cottage, overflowed through the casements into the dark world without. Most of the low-latticed windows were innocent of blinds, and to the lookers-in from outside, the inmates, gathered round the tea-table, absorbed in handiwork or talking with laughter and gesture, had each that happy grace which is the last thing the skilled actor shall capture. The natural grace which goes with perfect unconsciousness of observation. Moving at will from one theatre to another, the two spectators, so far from home themselves, had something of wistfulness in their eyes as they watched a cat being stroked, a sleepy child picked up and huddled off to bed, or a tired man stretch and knock out his pipe on the end of a smouldering log. But it was from one little window, with its blind drawn down, a mere blank transparency on the night, that the sense of home and the little curtained world within walls, the larger stressful world of outside nature shut out and forgotten, most pulsated. Close against the white blind hung a birdcage, clearly silhouetted, every wire, perch and appurtenance distinct and recognisable, even to yesterday's dull-edged lump of sugar. On the middle perch, the fluffy occupant, head tucked well into feathers, seemed so near to them as to be easily stroked, had they tried. Even the delicate tips of her plumped-out plumage penciled plainly on the illuminated screen. As they looked, the sleepy little creature stirred uneasily, woke, shook herself, and raised her head. They could see the gape of her tiny beak as she yawned in a bored sort of way, looked round, and then settled her head into her back again, while the ruffled feathers gradually subsided into perfect stillness. Then, a gust of bitter wind took them in the back of the neck. A small sting of frozen sleet on the skin woke them as from a dream, and they knew their toes to be cold and their legs to be tired, and their own home distant a weary way. Once beyond the village, where the cottages ceased abruptly, on either side of the road they could smell, through the darkness, the friendly fields again. and they brace themselves for the last long stretch, the home stretch, the stretch that we know is bound to end sometime in the rattle of the door latch, the sudden firelight, and the sight of familiar things greeting us as long, absent travellers from far oversea. They tramped along steadily and silently, each of them thinking her own thoughts. Moles ran a good deal on supper, as it was pitch dark. It was all a strange country for her, as far as she knew, and she was following obediently in the wake of Rat, leaving the guidance entirely to her. As for Rat, she was walking a little way ahead, as her habit was, her shoulders humped, her eyes fixed on the straight grey road in front of her. So she did not notice poor Mole when suddenly the summons reached her and took her like an electric shock. We others, who have long lost the more subtle of the physical senses, have not even proper terms to express an animal's intercommunications with her surroundings, living or otherwise, and have only the word smell, for instance, to include the whole range of delicate thrills which murmur in the nose of the animal night and day, summoning, warning, inciting, repelling. It was one of these mysterious fairy calls from out of the void that suddenly reached Mole in the darkness, making her tingle through and through with its very familiar appeal, even while yet she could not clearly remember what it was. She stopped dead in her tracks, her nose searching hither and thither in its efforts to recapture the fine filament, the telegraphic current that had so strongly moved her. A moment, and she had caught it again, and with it this time came recollection in fullest flood. Home! That was what they meant, those caressing appeals, those soft touches wafted through the air, those invisible little hands pulling and tugging all one way. Why, it must be quite close by her at that moment. Her old home that she had hurriedly forsaken and never sought again that day when she first found the river. And now it was sending out its scouts and its messengers to capture her and bring her in. Since her escape on that bright morning, she had hardly given it a thought. So absorbed had she been in her new life, in all its pleasures, its surprises, its fresh and captivating experiences. Now, with a rush of old memories, how clearly it stood up before her in the darkness. Shabby, indeed, and small, and poorly furnished, and yet hers. The home she had made for herself, the home she had, wisely or not, extended to an unreliable and frequently absent Mr. Mole, half hoping that it would one day be filled with the pitter-patter of tiny paws. And the home had perhaps shared the dream too, and was missing her, evidently, and wanted her back, and was telling her so, through her nose, sorrowfully, reproachfully, but with no bitterness or anger, only with plaintive reminder that it was there and wanted her. The call was clear. The summons was plain. She must obey it instantly and go.
Ratty!
She called, full of joyful excitement.
Hold on! Come back! I want you quick!
Oh, come along, Mole, do!
Replied Rat cheerfully, still plodding along.
Please stop, Ratty!
Pleaded poor Mole, in anguish of heart.
You don't understand. It's my home. My old home. I've just come across the smell of it and it's close by here, really quite close. And I must go to it, I must. Oh, come back, Ratty. Please come back.
Rat was by this time very far ahead, too far to hear clearly what Mole was calling, too far to catch the sharp note of painful appeal in her voice. And she was much taken up with the weather, for she too could smell something suspiciously like approaching snow.
Mole, we mustn't stop now, really,
she called back.
We'll come for it tomorrow, whatever it is you've found. But I daren't stop now. It's late, and the snow's coming on again, and I'm not sure of the way. And I want your nose, Mole, so come on quick, there's a good girl.
And Rat pressed forward on her way without waiting for an answer. Poor Mole stood alone in the road, her heart torn asunder, and a big sob gathering somewhere low down inside her to leap up to the surface presently, she knew, in passionate escape. But even under such a test as this, her loyalty to her friend stood firm. Never for a moment did she dream of abandoning her. Meanwhile, the wafts from her old home pleaded, whispered, conjured, and finally claimed her. She dared not tarry longer within their magic circle. With a wrench that tore her very heartstrings, she set her face down the road and followed submissively in the track of Rat, while faint, thin little smells, still dogging her retreating nose, reproached her for her new friendship and her callous forgetfulness. With an effort, she caught up with the unsuspecting Rat, who began chattering cheerfully about what they would do when they got back, and how jolly a fire of logs in the parlour would be, and what a supper she meant to eat, never noticing her companion's silence and distressful state of mind. At last, however, when they had gone some considerable way further and were passing some tree stumps at the edge of a copse that bordered the road, she stopped and said kindly,
"Look here, Mole, poor thing. You seem dead tired. No talk left in you, and your feet dragging like lead. We'll sit down here for a minute and rest. The snow has held off so far, and the best part of our journey is over."
Mole subsided forlornly on a tree stump and tried to control herself, for she felt it surely coming. The sob she had fought with so long refused to be beaten. Up and up, it forced its way to the air, and then another, and another, and others thick and fast, till poor Mole at last gave up the struggle and cried freely and helplessly and openly, now that she knew it was all over and she had lost what she could hardly be said to have found. Rat, astonished and dismayed at the violence of Mole's paroxysm of grief, did not dare to speak for a while. At last she said, very quietly and sympathetically,
"What is it, old girl? Whatever can be the matter? Tell us your trouble and let me see what I can do."
Poor Mole found it difficult to get any words out between the upheavals of her chest that followed one upon another so quickly and held back speech and choked it as it came.
"I know. It's a shabby, dingy little place,"
she sobbed forth at last, brokenly.
"Not like your cosy quarters, or Lady Toad's beautiful hall, or Mistress Badger's great house. But it was my own little home, and I was fond of it. And I went away and forgot all about it. And then I smelt it suddenly on the road when I called you and you wouldn't listen, Rat. And everything came back to me with a rush. And I wanted it. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. And when you wouldn't turn back, Ratty, and I had to leave it, though I was smelling it all the time, I thought my heart would break. We might have just gone and had one look at it, Ratty. Only one look. It was close by, but you wouldn't turn back, Ratty. You wouldn't turn back. Oh, dear. Oh, dear."
Recollection brought fresh waves of sorrow, and sobs again took full charge of her, preventing further speech. Rat stared straight in front of her, saying nothing, only patting Mole gently on the shoulder. After a time, she muttered gloomily,
"I see it all now. What a pig I have been. A pig. That's me. Just a pig. A plain pig."
She waited till Mole's sobs became gradually less stormy and more rhythmical.
She waited till at last sniffs were frequent and sobs only intermittent. Then she rose from her seat and, remarking carelessly,
"Well, now we really better be getting on, hadn't we?"
and set off.
"Wherever are you going to, Ratty?"
cried the tearful mole, looking up in alarm.
"We're going to find that home of yours, my dear,"
replied Rat pleasantly.
"So you had better come along, for it will take some finding, and we shall want your nose."
"Oh, come back, Ratty, do,"
cried Mole, getting up and hurrying after her.
"It's no good, I tell you. It's too late and too dark, and the place is too far off, and the snow's coming. And I never meant to let you know I was feeling that way about it. It was all an accident and a mistake. And think of the riverbank and your supper."
"Hang riverbank and supper too,"
said Rat heartily.
"I tell you, I'm going to find this place now if I stay out all night. So cheer up, Chuckaboo, and take my arm. We'll very soon be back there again."
Still snuffling, pleading, and reluctant, Mole suffered herself to be dragged back along the road by her resolute companion, who, by a flow of cheerful talk and anecdote, endeavoured to beguile her spirits back and make the weary way seem shorter. When at last it seemed to Rat that they must be nearing that part of the road where Mole had been held up, she said,
"Now, no more talking. Business. Use your nose and give your mind to it."
They moved on in silence for some little way, when suddenly Rat was conscious, through her arm that was linked in Mole's, of a faint sort of electric thrill that was passing down that animal's body. Instantly, she disengaged herself, fell back a pace, and waited, all attention. The signals were coming through. Mole stood a moment rigid, while her uplifted nose, quivering slightly, felt the air. Then a short, quick run forward, a vault, a check, a try back, and then a slow, steady, confident advance. Rat, much excited, kept close to her heels as Mole, with something of the air of a sleepwalker, crossed a dry ditch, scrambled through a hedge, and nosed her way over a field open and trackless and bare in the faint starlight. Suddenly, without giving warning, she dived, but Rat was on the alert, and promptly followed her down the tunnel to which her unerring nose had faithfully led her. It was close and airless, and the earthy smell was strong, and it seemed a long time to Rat ere the passage ended and she could stand erect and stretch and shake herself. Mole struck a match, and by its light, Rat saw that they were standing in an open space, neatly swept and sanded underfoot, and directly facing them was Mole's little front door, with "Mole End" painted in Gothic lettering over the bell pull at the side. Mole reached down a lantern from a nail on the wall and lit it, and Rat, looking round her, saw that they were in a sort of forecourt. A garden seat stood on one side of the door, and on the other, a roller, for Mole, who was a tidy animal when at home, could not stand having her ground kicked up by other animals into little runs that ended in earth heaps. On the walls hung wire baskets with ferns in them, alternating with brackets carrying plaster statuary, Garibaldi, and the infant Samuel, and Queen Victoria, and other heroes of modern Italy. Down on one side of the forecourt ran a skittle alley, with benches along it, and little wooden tables marked with rings that hinted at beer mugs. In the middle was a small, round pond containing goldfish and surrounded by a cockle-shell border. Out of the centre of the pond rose a fanciful erection clothed in more cockle-shells and topped by a large, silvered glass ball that reflected everything all wrong and had a very pleasing effect. Mole's face beamed at the sight of all these objects so dear to her. But then, an unwelcome thought wedged itself like a rock between her and the door. Would the long-abandoned Mr. Mole be waiting within, ready to admonish her for the very freedoms he had so casually and frequently afforded himself from the earliest days of their union? Probing the air for his distinctive musk, Mole's redoubtable nose told her otherwise. With great relief, she hurried Rat through the door, lit a lamp in the hall, and took one glance round her old home. She saw the dust lying thick on everything, saw the cheerless, deserted look of the long-neglected house, and its narrow, meagre dimensions, its worn and shabby contents, and collapsed again on a hall chair, her nose in her paws.
"Oh, Ratty,"
she cried dismally.
"Why ever did I do it? Why ever did I bring you to this poor, cold little place on a night like this, when you might have been at the riverbank by this time, toasting your toes before a blazing fire with all your own nice things about you?"
Rat paid no heed to her doleful self-reproaches. She was running here and there, opening doors, inspecting rooms and cupboards, and lighting lamps and candles and sticking them up everywhere.
"What a capital little house this is,"
she called out cheerily.
"Oh, so compact, so well planned. Everything here and everything in its place. Oh, we'll make a jolly night of it. The first thing we want is a good fire. I'll see to that. I always know where to find things."
As Rat's eyes darted around the room in search of fuel, she couldn't help but notice several items of the sort that sit on shelves or crowd surfaces, or lie about in crevices, that seemed out of place in Mole's carefully composed home. There was a flat cap, for instance, hanging from a corner hook, and a pair of old boots nestled beneath, rather large in size and bruised in nature. Taken together, these sundry items pointed toward an unavoidable conclusion. Mole End had, at one time or another, housed more than one mole. Since Rat knew that animal etiquette forbade any sort of comment on the sudden appearance or disappearance of a spouse at any moment for any reason or no reason whatever, she quickly moved to fill the silence.
"Oh, so this is the parlour? Oh, splendid! Your own idea? Those little sleeping bunks in the wall? Capital. Now, I'll fetch the wood and the cold. And you get the duster, Mole. You'll find one in the drawers in the kitchen table. And try to smarten things up a bit. Bustle about, my dear."
Encouraged by her inspiriting companion, Mole roused herself and dusted and polished with energy and heartiness, while Rat, running to and fro with armfuls of fuel, soon had a cheerful blaze roaring up the chimney. She hailed Mole to come and warm herself, but Mole promptly had another fit of the blues, dropping down on a couch in dark despair and burying her face in her duster.
"Rat,"
she moaned.
"How about your supper? You poor, cold, hungry, weary animal. I've nothing to give you. Nothing. Not a crumb."
"What a goose you are for giving in,"
said Rat reproachfully.
"Why, only just now I saw a sardine opener on the kitchen dresser, quite distinctly, and everybody knows that means there are sardines about somewhere in the neighbourhood. Rouse yourself, pull yourself together, and come with me and forage."
They went and foraged accordingly, hunting through every cupboard and turning out every drawer. The result was not so very depressing after all, though of course it might have been better. A tin of sardines, a box of captain's biscuits nearly full, and a German sausage encased in silver paper.
"There's a banquet for you,"
observed Rat as she arranged the table.
"I know some animals who would give their ears to be sitting down to supper with us tonight."
"No bread,"
groaned Mole dolorously.
"No butter, no..."
"No pâté de foie gras, no champagne,"
continued Rat, grinning.
"Oh, and that reminds me, what's that little door at the end of the passage? Oh, your cellar, of course! Every luxury in this house. Just you wait a minute.
She made for the cellar door and presently reappeared, somewhat dusty, with a bottle of beer in each paw and another under each arm.
Self-indulgent soul you seem to be, Mole,
she observed.
Deny yourself nothing. Oh, this is really the jolliest little place I ever was in. Now, wherever did you pick up those prints? Make the place look so homelike. They do. No wonder you're so fond of it, dear. Tell us all about it and how you came to make it what it is.
Then, while Rat busied herself fetching plates and knives and forks and mustard, which she mixed, in an egg cup, Mole, her bosom still heaving with the stress of her recent emotion, related, somewhat shyly at first, but with more freedom as she warmed to her subject, how this was planned, and how that was thought out, and how this was got through a windfall from an aunt, and that was a wonderful find and a bargain, and this other thing was bought out of laborious savings and a certain amount of going without. Her spirits finally quite restored, she must needs go and caress her possessions, and take a lamp and show off their points to her visitor and expatiate on them, quite forgetful of the supper they both so much needed. Rat, who was desperately hungry but strove to conceal it, nodding seriously, examining with a puckered brow and saying,
"Wonderful,"
and
"Most remarkable,"
at intervals when the chance for an observation was given her. At last, Rat succeeded in decoying her to the table and had just got seriously to work with the sardine opener when sounds were heard from the forecourt without. Sounds like the scuffling of small feet in gravel and a confused murmur of tiny voices while broken sentences reached them.
"Now, all in a line. Hold the lantern up a bit, Tommy. Clear your throats first. No coughing after I say 1, 2, 3. Where's young Shelley?"
I'm coming.
Here, come on, do. We're all awaiting."
"What's up?"
inquired Rat, pausing in her labours.
"I think it must be the field mice,"
replied Mole, with a touch of pride in her manner.
"They go round carol singing regularly at this time of the year. They're quite an institution in these parts, and they never pass me over. They come to Mole End last of all, and I used to give them hot drinks and supper too sometimes, when I could afford it. It will be like the old times to hear them again."
"Let's have a look at them,"
cried Rat, jumping up and running to the door. It was a pretty sight, and a seasonable one, that met their eyes when they flung the door open. In the forecourt, lit by the dim rays of a horn lantern, some 8 or 10 little field mice stood in a semicircle, red worsted comforters round their throats, their forepaws thrust deep into their pockets, their feet jigging for warmth. With bright, beady eyes, they glanced shyly at each other, sniggering a little, sniffing, and applying coat sleeves a good deal. As the door opened, one of the elder ones that carried the lantern was just saying,
"Now then, 1, 2, 3.
And forthwith their shrill little voices uprose on the air, singing one of the old-time carols that their ancestors composed in fields that were fallow and held by frost, or when snowbound in chimney corners, and handed down to be sung in the miry street to lamp-lit windows at Yuletime.
Villagers, all this frosty tide, let your doors ring open wide. The wind may follow and snow beside, yet draw us in by your fire to bide. Joy shall be yours in the morning.
Merry, 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 merry.
Here we stand in the cold and the sleet.
It's cold.
Blowing fingers and stamping feet. Come from far away, you to greet. You by the fire and we in the street, bidding you joy in the morning.
For ere one half of the night was gone, sudden a star has led us on.
Ray and many songs. Blissful morrow and more anon. Joy for every morning.
The voices ceased. The singers, bashful but smiling, exchanged sidelong glances, and silence succeeded, but for a moment only. Then, from up above and far away, down the tunnel they had so lately travelled, was borne to their ears in a faint musical hum the sound of distant bells ringing a joyful and clangorous peal.
"Oh, very well sung, my dears!"
cried Rat heartily.
"And now come along in, all of you, and warm yourselves by the fire and have something hot."
"Yes, come along, dearies,"
cried Mole eagerly.
"This is quite like old times. Shut the door after you. Pull up that settle to the fire. Now you just wait a minute while we..." "Oh, Ratty, whatever are we doing? We've nothing to give them."
"You leave all that to me," said the enterprising Rat. "Here, you dear, with the lantern. Come over this way. I want to talk to you. And now, tell me, are there any shops open at this hour of the night?"
"Why, certainly, ma'am,"
replied the field mouse respectfully.
"At this time of the year, our shops keep open to all sorts of hours."
"Then look here,"
said Rat.
"You go off at once, you and your lantern, and you get me..."
Here, much muttered conversation ensued, and Mole only heard bits of it, such as,
"Fresh mind. No, a pound of that will do. See you get Buggins, for I won't have any other. Oh, no, only the best. Well, if you can't get it there, try somewhere else. Yes, of course, homemade, no tinned stuff. Well, then, do the best you can."
Finally, there was a chink of coin passing from paw to paw. The field mouse was provided with an ample basket for his purchases, and off he hurried, he and his lantern. The rest of the field mice, perched in a row on the settle, their small legs swinging, gave themselves up to enjoyment of the fire and toasted their chilblains till they tingled, while Mole, failing to draw them into easy conversation, plunged into family history and made each of them recite the names of their numerous siblings, who were too young, it appeared, to be allowed to go out a-carolling this year, but looked forward very shortly to winning the parental consent. Rat picked up a bottle of beer.
"I perceive this to be old Burton,"
she remarked approvingly.
"Sensible, Mole. The very thing. Now we shall be able to mull some ale. Get the things ready, Mole, while I draw the corks."
It did not take long to prepare the brew and thrust the tin heater well into the heart of the fire. And soon, all the field mice were sipping and coughing and choking, for a little mulled ale goes a long way, and wiping their eyes and laughing and forgetting they had ever been so cold in all their lives.
"They act plays too, these little uns,"
Mole explained to Rat.
"Make them up all by themselves and act them afterwards. Very well they do it too. They gave us a capital one last year about a field mouse who was captured at sea by a Barbary corsair and made to row in a galley. And when he escaped and got home again, his lady love had gone into a convent. Here, you were in it. I remember. Get up and recite a bit.
The field mouse addressed, got up on his legs, giggled shyly, looked round the room, and remained absolutely tongue-tied. His comrades cheered him on. Mole coaxed and encouraged him, and Rat went so far as to take him by the shoulders and shake him, but nothing could overcome his stage fright. They were all busily engaged on him, like mariners applying the Royal Humane Society's regulations to a case of long submersion, when the latch clicked, the door opened, and the field mouse with the lantern reappeared, staggering under the weight of his basket. There was no more talk of play-acting once the very real and solid contents of the basket had been tumbled out on the table. Under the command of Rat, everybody was set to do something or to fetch something. In a very few minutes, supper was ready, and Mole, as she took the head of the table in sort of a dream, saw a lately barren board set thick with savoury comforts, saw her little friends' faces brighten and beam as they fell to without delay, and then let herself loose, for she was famished indeed, on the provender so magically provided, thinking what a happy homecoming this had turned out after all. As they ate, they talked of old times, and the field mice gave her the local gossip up to date, and answered as well as they could the 100 questions she had to ask them. Rat said little or nothing, only taking care that each guest had what he or she wanted and plenty of it, and that Mole had no trouble or anxiety about anything. They clattered off at last, very grateful and showering wishes of the season, with their jacket pockets stuffed with remembrances for the small brothers and sisters at home. When the door had closed on the last of them and the chink of the lanterns had died away, Mole and Rat kicked the fire up, drew their chairs in, brewed themselves a last nightcap of mulled ale, and discussed the events of the long day. At last, Rat, with a tremendous yawn, said,
Mole, dear, I'm ready to drop. Sleepy is simply not the word. That your own bunk over on that side? Very well, then. I'll take this. What a ripping little house this is. Everything so handy.
She clambered into her bunk and rolled herself well up in the blankets, and slumber gathered her forthwith as a swathe of barley is folded into the arms of the reaping machine. The weary Mole also was glad to turn in without delay, and soon had her head on a pillow in great joy and contentment. But ere she closed her eyes, she let them wander round her old room. Mellow in the glow of the firelight that played or rested on familiar and friendly things which had long been unconsciously a part of her and now smilingly received her back without rancour. She was now in just the frame of mind that the tactful Rat had quietly worked to bring about in her. She saw clearly how plain and simple, how narrow even, it all was, but clearly, too, how much it all meant to her, and the special value of some such anchorage in one's existence. She did not at all want to abandon the new life and its splendid spaces, to turn her back on sun and air and all they offered her and creep home and stay there. The upper world was all too strong. It called to her still, even down there, and she knew she must return to the larger stage. But it was good to think she had this to come back to. This place, which was all her own. These things, which were so glad to see her again. And could always be counted upon for the same simple welcome.